Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is the discussion portion of How to Cure Inflation, part of Volume 9 of the 10-part public television series Free to Choose. Milton Friedman is joined by other guests at the University of Chicago to discuss some of the ideas presented in the documentary segment of How to Cure Inflation. Listen now, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
If you can control the money supply, you can certainly cut back or control the rate of inflation. I'd have to say that that prescription is a little bit easier to write than it is to fill. I think there are some other ways to do it, and I would relate the money supply. I think inflation is a measure of the relationship between money and the goods and services that money is meant to cover. And so if you can stimulate the production of goods and services, it's helpful. It's a little tougher to control the money supply, although I think it can be done, than just saying that you should control it, because we've had the growth of credit cards, which is a form of money created, in effect, by the free enterprise system. It isn't all just printed in Washington. But that may sound too defensive. I think he was right in saying it was that the inflation is Washington-based.
Mr. Martin, nobody's been in the firing line longer than you, 17 years head of the Fed. Could you briefly comment on that, and we'll go around the group?
I'd want to say 19 years. No. I wouldn't be out here if it weren't for Milton Friedman today. He came down and gave us advice from time to time.
Never taken
him. He's going to do some interviewing later, I warn
and
you.
I'm rather glad we didn't take a seat all the time.
In your 19 years as chairman of the Federal Reserve, Bill, the average growth in the money supply was 3.1% per year. The inflation rate was 2.2%. Since you left, the money supply has exactly doubled. The inflation rate is averaged over 7%. And of course, in recent times, the money supply has been growing in double-digit territory, as has our inflation rate.
May I first of all confirm two facts which have been so vividly brought out in the film of Professor Friedman, namely that at the basis of the relatively good performance of Western Germany were really two events. One, the establishment of a new sound money, which we tried to preserve sound afterwards, and secondly, the jump overnight into a free market economy without any controls over prices and wages. These were the two fundamental facts. Now, we have tried to preserve monetary stability by just trying to follow this prescription of Professor Friedman, namely monetary discipline, keeping monetary growth relatively moderate. I must, however, warn you, it's not so easy as it looks. If you just say governments have to have the courage to persist in that course.
Yeah. Nobody does disagree with the proposition that excessive growth in money supply is an essential element in the inflationary process, and that the real problem is not what to do, but how to have the courage and the will to do it. And I want to go and start, if I may, on that subject, because I think that's what we ought to explore. Why is it we haven't had the courage and don't, and under what circumstances will we? And I want to start with Bill Martin, because his experience is a very interesting experience. His 19 years was divided into different periods. In the first period, that average that Burl Sprinkle spoke about, averaged two very different periods, an early period of very slow growth and slow inflation, a later period of what at the time was regarded as creeping inflation. Now we'd be delighted to get back to it. People don't remember that at the time that Mr. Nixon introduced price and wage controls in 1971 to control an outrageous inflation. The rate of inflation was 4.5% per year. Today, we'd regard that as a major achievement. But the latter part of the period when you were chairman was a period when the inflation rate was starting to creep up and money growth rate was also creeping up. Now, if I go from your period, you were eloquent in your statements to the public, to the press, to everyone about the evils of inflation and about the determination of the Federal Reserve not to be the architect of inflation. Your successor, Arthur Burns, was just as eloquent, made exactly the same kinds of statements as effectively, and again, over and over again, said the Federal Reserve will not be the architect of inflation. his successor, Mr. G. William Miller, made the same speeches and the same statements and the same protestations. His successor, Paul Volcker, he is making the same statements. Now, my question to you is, why is it that there has been such a striking difference between the excellent pronouncements of all chairmen of the Fed? Therefore, it's not personal on you. You have a lot of company, unfortunately, for the country. Why is it that there's been such a wide diversion between the excellent pronouncements on the one hand and what I regard as a very poor performance on the other?
Because monetary policy is not the only element. Fiscal policy is equally important.
You're shifting the buck to the Treasury.
Yes.
To the Congress. We'll get to Mr. Brown,
yeah,
don't worry.
Right. The relationship of fiscal policy to monetary policy is one of the important things.
Could you remind us, the general audience, when you say fiscal policy, what you mean in distinction to monetary policy?
Well, taxation,
yep.
The raising revenue.
And spending.
Yep.
And deficits,
yes, exactly. And I think that you have to realize that when I've talked for a long time about the independence of the Federal Reserve, that's independence within the government, not independence of the government. And I've worked consistently with the Treasury to try to see that the government is financed. Now, this gets back to spending. The government says they're going to spend a certain amount, and then it turns out they don't spend that amount. It doubles.
The job of the Federal Reserve is not to run government spending. It's not to run government taxation. The job of the Federal Reserve is to control the money supply. And I believe, frankly, I have always believed, as you know, that these are excuses and not reasons for
the performance. Well, that's where you and I differ, because I think we would be irresponsible if we didn't take into account the needs and what the government is saying and doing. I think if we just went on our own irresponsibly, I say it on this, because I was in the Treasury before I came to the Fed, and I know the other side of the picture. I think we'd be rightly condemned by the American people and by the electorate.
Every central bank in this world, including the German central bank, including the Federal Reserve System, has the technical capacity to make the money supply do over a period of 2 or 3 or 4 months, not daily, but over a period, has the technical capacity to control it.
Dr. Vaughan,
I cannot explain the kind of excessive money creation that has occurred in terms of the technical incapacity of the Federal Reserve System or of the German Central Bank or the Bank of England or any other central bank in the world.
I wouldn't say technically we are incapable of doing that, although we have never succeeded in controlling the money supply month by month.
That's right.
But I would say we can technically control it half yearly, from one half year period to the next, and that would be sufficient.
That would be
for
sufficient.
Controlling inflation.
It's like steering a ship; it doesn't move.
I'm an economic scientist, and I'm trying to observe phenomena. And I observe that every Federal Reserve chairman says one thing and does another. I don't mean he does; the system does.
Yep. How different is your setup in Germany? You've heard this problem of governments getting committed to spending, and the Fed having one way or the other to accommodate itself to it. Now, what's your position on this very interesting problem?
We are very independent of the government, from the government, but on the other hand, we are an advisor of the government, also on their budget deficits. And they would not easily go before Parliament with a deficit in their budget, which is openly criticized and disapproved by the central bank. Why? Because we have a tradition in our country that we can also publicly criticize the government on this account. And second, if, as has happened in our case too, the government goes beyond what is tolerable for the sake of overall equilibrium, we have let it come through in the capital markets. That is to say, they have driven up interest rates, that has drawn public criticism, and that has had some effect on their attitude.
I think that's a very important point that Dr. Eminger just made, because there is not a one-to-one relationship between government deficits and what happens to the money supply at all. The pressure on the Federal Reserve comes indirectly. It comes because large government deficits, if they are financed in the general capital market, will drive up interest rates. And then we have the right Patmans in Congress and their successors pressuring the Federal Reserve to enter in and finance the deficit by printing money. as a way of supposedly holding down interest rates. Now, before I turn to Mr. Brown and ask him that, I just want to make one point which is very important. The Federal Reserve's activities in trying to hold down interest rates have put us in a position where we have the highest interest rates in history. It's another example of how of the difference between the announced intentions of a policy and the actual result. But now I want to come to Clarence Brown and ask him, shift the buck to him and put him on the hot seat for a bit. The government spending has been going up rapidly, Republican administration or Democratic administration. This is a nonpartisan issue. It doesn't matter. Right. Government deficits have been going up rapidly, Republican administration or Democratic administration. Why is it that here again you have the difference between pronouncements and performance? There is no congressman, no senator, who will come out and say, I am in favor of inflation. There is not a single one who will say, I am in favor of big deficits. They'll all say, we want to balance the budget, we want to hold down spending, we want an economical government. How do you explain the difference between performance and talk on the side of Congress?
Well, first, I think we have to make one point. I'm not so much with the government as I am against it.
I understand.
As you know, I'm a minority member of Congress.
Again, I'm not directing this at you personally.
I understand, of course. And while the administrations, as you mentioned, Republican and Democratic administrations, have both been responsible for increases in spending, at least in terms of their recommendation, it is the Congress, and only the Congress, that appropriates the funds and determines what the taxes are. The president has no authority to do that, and so one must lay it at the feet of the U.S. Congress. Now, I guess we'd have to concede that it's a little bit more fun to give away things than it is to withhold them, and this is the reason that the Congress responds to a general public that says, well, I want you to cut everybody else's program, but the one in which I am most particularly interested, save money, but incidentally, my wife is taking care of the orphanages, and so let's try to help the orphanages, or whatever it is. Let me try to make a point, if I can, however, on what I think is a new spirit moving within the Congress, and that is that inflation as a national affliction is beginning to have an impact on the political psychology of many Americans. Now, the Germans, the Japanese, and others have had this terrific post-war inflation. The Germans have been through it twice after World War I and World War II, and it's a part of their national psyche. But we are affected in this country by the Depression. Our whole tax structure is built on the Depression. The idea of the tax structure in the past has been to get the money out of the mattress, where it went after the banks failed in this country and jobs were lost, and out of the woodshed or the tin box in the backyard, get it out of there and put it into circulation, get it moving, get things going. And one of the ways to do that was to encourage inflation, because if you held on to it, the money would depreciate. And the other way was to tax it away from people and let the government spend it. Now there's a reaction to that. And people are beginning to say, wait just a minute, we're not afflicted as much as we were by depression. We're now afflicted by inflation, and we'd like for you to get it under control. Now, you can do that in another way, and that without reducing the money supply radically. I think the Joint Economic Committee has recommended that we do it gradually. But the way that you can do it is to reduce taxes and the impact of government, that is, the weight of government, and increase private saving so that the private saving can finance some of the debt that you have.
There is no way you can do it without reducing, in my opinion, the rate of monetary growth. And I, recognizing the facts, even though they ought not to be that way, I wonder whether you can reduce the rate of monetary growth unless Congress actually does reduce government spending as well as government taxes.
The problem is that every time we use demand management, we get into a kind of an Iron Maiden kind of situation. We twist this way, and one of the spikes grabs us here, so we twist that way, and a spike over here gets us. And every recession has had higher basic unemployment rates Absolutely. Than the previous recession in the last several years, and every inflation has had higher inflation. We've got to get that tilt out of the society.
Would it be fair to say, though, that a fundamental difference is the Germans are more deeply fearful of a return to inflation, having had the horrifying experience between the wars especially? We tend to be more afraid of recession turning into depression.
I think there is something in it, and in particular, in Germany, a government would have to fear very much in their electoral prospects if they went into such an election period with a high inflation rate. But there's another important difference.
We fear unemployment.
You fear
more
unemployment.
Than inflation, it seems. Yeah.
Well, unemployment is feared with us too, but inflation is just as much feared. But there's another difference. Namely, once you have got into that escalating inflation, where every time the base, the plateau is higher, it's extremely difficult to get out of it. You must avoid getting into that now. That's a very cheap advice from me because you are there already. But we have, for the last 15, 20 years, always studied foreign experiences and told ourselves we never must get into this vicious circle. Once you are in, it takes a long time to get out of it. That is what I'm preaching now, that we should avoid at all costs to get again into this vicious circle as we had it already in 73, 74. It took us also 4 years to get out of it, although we were only at 8% inflation. 4 years to get down to 3%.
So wow. Yes.
Now you have, I think, the question whether you can do it in a gradualist way over many, many years, or whether you don't need a sort of shock treatment.
The film showed it took the Japanese, what, 4 years?
5 years.
5 years.
Five years. One of my greatest concerns is that we haven't suffered enough yet. Mm-hmm. Most of the nations that have finally got their inflation.
Speech, I can tell you.
Well, I'm not running for office, Clarence. Most countries that finally got their inflation under control had 20, 30% or worse inflation. Germany had much worse, and the public supports them. We live in a democracy. And we're getting constituencies that gain from inflation. If you look at people that own real estate, they've done very well. And how can we get there without going through even more pain? And I doubt that we will.
If you ask who are the constituencies that have benefited most from inflation, there are no doubt. It is the homeowners, but it's also the congressmen who have been able to vote higher spending without having to vote higher taxes. Congress has in fact voted for inflation, but you have never had a congressman on record to that effect. It's the government civil servants who have their own salaries are indexed and tied to inflation. They have a retirement benefit, a retirement pension that's tied to inflation. They qualify a large fraction of them for Social Security as well, which is tied to inflation. So that the beneficiary
labor contracts that are and pricing things that are tied
but the
to
one
inflation.
Thing that isn't tied to inflation, and here I want to come back and ask why Congress has been so bad in this area, is our taxes. It has been impossible to get Congress to index the tax system so that you don't have the present effect, where every 1% increase in inflation pushes people up into higher brackets and forces them to pay higher taxes.
Well, as you know, I'm an advocate of that.
I know you are.
Well, some countries do that, of course. Canada does. Yes. Canada indexes does.
I went up to Canada on a little weekend seminar program on indexing and came back an advocate of indexing because I found out that the people who are delighted with indexing are the taxpayers because as the inflation rate goes up, their tax level either maintains its same level or goes down. The people who are very unhappy with it are the people who have to plan government spending. Because it is reducing the amount of money that the government has rather than watching it go up by 10 or 12 billion. You get a little dividend to spend in this country, the bureaucrats do every year. But the politicians are unhappy with it too, as Dr. Friedman points out, because you see, the politicians don't get to vote a tax reduction. It happens automatically. And so you can't go back and in a praiseworthy way, tell your constituents that I am for you, I voted the tax reduction. And I think we ought to be able to index the tax system so that that tax reduction is automatic rather than have what we've had in the past, and that is an automatic increase in the taxes. And the politicians say, well, we're sorry about inflation, but you're right.
Well, I want to go and make a very different point. I sit here and berate you and you as government officials and so on. But I understand very well that the real culprit are not the politicians, are not the central bankers, but it's I and my fellow citizens. I always say to people when I talk about this, if you want to know who's responsible for inflation, look in the mirror. It's not because of the way you spend your money. Inflation doesn't arise because you got consumers who are spendthrift. They've always been spendthrift. It doesn't arise because you've got the businessmen who are greedy. They've always been greedy. Inflation arises because we as citizens have been asking you as politicians to perform an impossible task. We've been asking you to spend somebody else's money on us, but not to spend our money on anybody else.
You don't want us to cut back those dollars for education, right?
And therefore, well, no, I do. We've already had a program on that, and there's no viewer of these programs who will be any doubt about my position on that. But the public at large has not, and this is where we come to the political will that Dr. Emminger quite properly talked about. Everybody talks against inflation, but what he means is that he wants the prices of the things he sells to go up and the prices of the things he buys to go down. But sooner or later, we come to the point where it will be politically profitable to end inflation. This is the point that I think you were making.
The suffering.
What do you think the rate of inflation has to be, and judged by the experience of other countries, before we will be in that position, and when do you think that'll happen?
Well, the evidence says it's got to be over 20%. Now, you would think we could learn from others rather than have to repeat mistakes.
Apparently, nobody can learn from history.
But at the present time, we're going toward higher, not lower inflation.
You said earlier, if you want to see who causes the inflation, look in the mirror.
Right.
Now, for everybody watching and taking part in this, there must be some moral to that. What has to be the change of attitude of the man in the mirror you're looking at before we can effectively implement what you call a tough policy that takes courage?
I think that the man in the mirror has to come to recognize that inflation is the most destructive disease known to modern societies. There is nothing which will destroy a society so thoroughly and so fully as letting inflation run riot. He must come to recognize that he doesn't have any good choices, that there are no easy answers, and once you get in this situation where the economy is sick of this insidious disease, there's going to be no miracle drug which will enable him to be well tomorrow. That the only choices he has, do I go through a tough period for 4 or 5 years of relatively high unemployment, relatively low growth, or do I try to push it off by taking some more of the hair of the dog that bit me and get around it now at the cost of still higher unemployment, as Clarence Brown said later on. The only choice this country faces is whether we have temporary unemployment for a short period as a side effect of curing inflation, or whether we go into a period of still higher unemployment later on and have it to do all over again. That's the only choice we face. And when the public at large recognizes that, they will then elect people to Congress, a president to office, who is committed to less government spending and to less government printing of money. And until that happens, we will not cure inflation.
So, Dr. Friedman, let me differ with you to this extent. I think it is important that at the time you are trying to get inflation out of the economy, that you also give the man in the street, the common man, the opportunity to have a little bit more of his own resources to spend. And if you can reduce his taxes at that time and then reduce government in that process, you give him his money to spend rather than having him yield up all that money to government. If you cut his taxes in a way to encourage it to putting that money into savings, you can encourage the additional savings in a private sense to finance the debt that you have to carry. And you can also encourage the stimulation of growth in the society, that is, the investment into capital improvements, modernization of plant, make the U.S. more competitive with other countries, and we can try to do it without as much painful unemployment as we can get by with. Don't you think that has some merit?
I am all in favor, as you know, of cutting government spending. I am all in favor of getting rid of the counterproductive government regulation that reduces productivity and disrupts investment.
And if we do that, we can cut taxes some, can we not?
We should. Taxes, but you are introducing a confusion that has confused the American people. And that is a confusion between spending and taxes. The real tax on the American people is not what you label taxes. It's total spending. If Congress spends $50 billion more than it takes in, if government spends $50 billion, who do you suppose pays that $50 billion?
Of course.
The Arab sheiks aren't paying it. Santa Claus isn't paying it. The Tooth Fairy isn't paying it. You and I, as taxpayers, are paying it indirectly through hidden taxation.
Therefore, the crucial thing
is to cut down total government spending from the point of view of inflation. From the point of view of productivity, some of the other measures you were talking about are far more important.
But if you concede that inflation and taxes are both part and parcel of the same thing, and if you cut spending...
They're not part and parcel of the same thing.
If you cut spending, you take the money from them in one way or another, the average citizen,
absolutely,
to finance the growth of government. Absolutely. So if you cut back the size of government, you can cut both their inflation and their taxes.
That's right.
I
am all in favor of that.
All right.
Don't kid yourself into thinking that there is some painless way to do it. There just is not.
One other way is productivity. If you can increase production, then the impact of inflation is less because you have more goods chasing.
Absolutely, but you have to have a sense of proportion. From the point of view of the real income of the American people, nothing is more important than increasing productivity. But from the point of view of inflation, it's a bit actor. It would be a miracle if we could raise our productivity from 3 to 5% a year. That would reduce inflation by 2%.
What happened overnight? It's part of the long range squeezing out.
In my opinion, there's only one way to ease the pains of curing inflation, and that way is not available. That way is to make it credible to the American people that you are really going to follow the policy you say you're going to follow. Unfortunately, I don't see any way we can do that.
Professor Friedman, that's exactly the point which I wanted to illustrate by our own experience. We also had to squeeze out inflation, and there was a painful time of 1.5 years. But after that, we had a continuous lowering of the inflation rate with a slow upward movement in the economy since 1975. Year by year, inflation went down, and we had a moderate growth rate which has led us now to full employment. You can shorten this period by just this credibility and by a consensus you must have also with the trade unions, with the whole population, that they acknowledge that policy and also play their part in it. Then the pains will be much less.
You see, in our case, expectations are that inflation is going to get worse because it always has. This means we must disappoint in a very painful way those expectations, and it's likely to take longer, at least the first time around. Now, our real problem has not been that we haven't tried. We have tried and brought inflation down. Our real problem was we didn't stick to it.
That's it.
Then you have it all to do over.
I would concede that psychology plays a great, perhaps even the major part. But I do believe that if you have private savings stimulated by your tax system, rather than discouraged by your tax system, you can finance some of that public debt by private savings rather than by inflation. And the result will be to ease to some degree the pain of that heavy unemployment that you seem to suggest is the only way to deal with the problem.
The talk is fine, but the problem is it is used to evade the key issue. How do you make it credible to the public that you are really going to stick to a policy? 4 times we've tried it, and 4 times we've stopped before we had run the court.
There we leave the matter for tonight, and next week's concluding program in this series is not to be missed. From the Harper Library, goodbye.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.